Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
I hope there's some people hanging on out there who normally listen to Rick and Gary, and thanks Steve Cormier, the producer's father, who's the GM. God, did I get your name right?
Pete.
Yeah.
Pete.
I got it right.
Or Corm, whichever one you feel
like. Mini Corm.
There you go.
Yeah, Mini Corm. And thanks, Ken Squire. You know, the first time I stepped in this here studio to do stuff was when Jack Donovan was hosting Vermont Live, and he would have bands up here, Patrick, and I was 15, so some 60. Been coming here a long time. Although the station's 90 years old. Is that correct, Pete? I've been nearly 90 years old.
You're 60 now?
Yeah. I know it. Count the rings.
Yeah. Well, damn, you're in good shape for 60.
I mean, what are you?
39.
That's weird. Sure. Isn't it? Or is it not?
No, I feel good about it, actually.
Well, your father didn't live really, really long. How is that, if you want to explain that to us a little bit? Well, first of all, Patrick Ross is far and above any musician that I've really mostly ever played with. I shouldn't say that because it discounts other people, but he's been playing fiddle and stuff since he's a little dinky kid. And he's going to play it for you here. So hang on, people, and we're going to get to talk about his age relative to his father's ending age. I do want to say that in the second hour, this is going to be Patrick, music and life. And then at 10, Ryan Cochran Siegel is a World Cup skier, alpine, one of the best skiers, not in America, in the world right now. And then his cousin Jimmy, who is one of the best skiers in the world. Ryan's still racing. Jimmy's running Cochran's. You guys ski at Cochran's?
No, I have not. We go to Northeast Slopes.
Because you're married to Cindy.
And, yeah, and we live near Northeast Slopes, and we love it.
Right, and that's the point. Jimmy's going to talk about the affordability. Northeast Slopes is affordable, and that's good. So, yeah, we got a wicked show coming in here, man. It's coming in hot. It is coming in hot. So you grew up where?
I grew up in Canaan, Vermont, which is not to be confused with Canaan, New Hampshire for a lot of people. Canaan, Vermont is the northeast pinpoint of the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont on the border of Canada and New Hampshire.
It's right up. If you're looking at the map, it's all the way right, a little, like you say, pinpoint.
Yeah, you can see New Hampshire and Canada, you know, from where I grew up.
You sound like Sarah Palin a little bit.
Ah.
And then tell me the Berlin. I knew you guys lived in Berlin, New Hampshire, right?
Yeah, we would call it Berlin.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. Very, very – it's a melting pot of New Hampshire for sure, especially in the 50s. It was the second biggest city in New Hampshire. A lot of woods workers because of the paper mill. My grandfather worked at the paper mill. My father grew up in Berlin. And I think just because it was such a melting pot and in the culture of the 40s and 50s, live music and particularly traditional music of all sorts, especially French-Canadian, was just, you know, boiling in Berlin, New Hampshire.
Yeah, and of course we say Berlin, Vermont. It's a weird thing. Just like you said, woods, trucking logs and stuff like that.
Hardworking people who, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 hours a week was nothing. And then here comes the weekend and it's boom, it's party time.
It's party time. And then you would get the knock on the door?
Well, my father would get the knock on the door because my grandfather played fiddle. And, you know, I am a fifth generation fiddle player. So my grandfather worked in the paper mills and then on the weekends would just go from club to club to club playing music and light up the town. And my dad, Arthur, and his brother, Paul, grew up in that musical environment.
Right.
And my grandfather really wanted to have a custom band. And so sort of nurtured them into playing guitar and mandolin so that he could come home and have musicians to play with and keep the party going. And so it was very common for my father and my uncle to be roused out of bed, you know, in the wee hours of the morning or late night when they were just starting to play music. Come on, les enfants, c'est temps de jouer de musique. Amenez-vous, c'est temps. And so that's kind of that.
That's how he. That's how your dad got to learn it.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of dragged his feet a little bit because he was told to play the guitar. You know, he did it, but then eventually his passion was he wanted to play the fiddle.
Right, and he did.
He did, but he had to do it behind my grandfather's back, which was kind of weird.
Because your father wanted the guitar, rhythm guitar in the band. He just wanted that.
My grandfather wanted the rhythm guitar, right. And my dad was like, "Well, I want to do what you're doing."
Lead instrument.
Yeah. So eventually, he picked up a fiddle and was able to figure it out just by being around it. And my grandfather succumbed. He was like, "Well, all right, I guess you're 18 and you're good. So let's do this."
When's the first? What was the age you first picked up a fiddle?
Oh, I can't remember.
You can't remember.
I mean, it was always available from when I can ever remember. At least a little toy instrument that I could kind of beat on and, you know, throw around.
So by the time you're 12 years old, you have, like the guys and girls that learn to fly the planes, they need a certain amount of hours. You had enough hours to be a captain or...
by 12 years old, I was playing in bands.
Okay. And you, would they pay you?
Yeah. $15 a night or dinner.
Really? Just one quick outline of a type of a place you would play back then, the VFWs and things?
Yes and no. I think one in particular was my weekly gig. It was at the Candlelight Restaurant. It was in the corner while people were having dinner, and it was the Brooks family. It was Caroline Brooks on the clavinova, and her husband Brad on the electric bass. Sometimes Roland Cutnoir on the acoustic guitar, and we'd play tunes like "Faded Love," like the Tennessee Waltz, the Rugged Cross. You know, a lot of hymns, kind of laid back, casual acoustic music.
I sort of give Patrick listeners. I give Patrick an outline of kind of what I'm going to ask and think. What songs we're going to play first. And this is not the one that we outlined, but can you play "Faded Love" a little bit?
Oh yeah, sure.
Right now? So I'm springing this on him because I used to play in bands, as you know, and they play fiddle. Play that on that fiddle. To give you the keep going sign. I mean, I'm almost in tears because is that Bob Wills?
I do believe so.
Yeah. And how long since you've played that tune?
I think you and I might have dabbled with it. A couple of years ago. But
you think of that. I ask him to play that tune and it sounds like that in a cramped, Pete, the cramped up studio. We have no bingers or bangers or Dr. Seuss ringers on these things.
No.
And he was getting three or four notes, five, six notes out of one note. By the way, 244-1777 to talk to Patrick Ross, 877-291-8255.
Don't be shy.
No, don't be shy. Call on in. Okay, now we're playing. You're a young kid. We get that, I think. And then your father is, you're learning a lot of tunes from your father. One question. When you're 12, are you better than your father at the fiddle?
Well, when I was 12, he had already passed.
He was toward the end of his life. Were you catching up with him, tone, technique? Because he's a working man.
Totally.
And you're a kid.
Yeah, my dad was a welder, also a fishing guide, also the maintenance, guy for the motel that my parents owned on the lake. And so he was clearly a weekend warrior, so to speak, and the music was a relief for him. It was something to kind of get away from the work, and that, I think that's really what kind of drew me to the music, because my parents owned a motel, which meant that there was always a place to gather for people. And so my dad and his musician friends from all over New England, they would get together. It seemed like every weekend. Mm-hmm. And so when I was a little kid, I was just buzzing around with friends and whatnot. And that music was live music in the kitchen, outside, depending on the time of the year. And I could just see my dad's face and that music that was being played, that there was just more to it than like, you know, just sounding good. It was like this release and this camaraderie and this community. And so that drew me like a moth to the flame, so to speak.
Yeah. I wonder if people that book learn music, you teach lessons.
Yeah.
So there are people that book learn music and they don't see, because this is the thing that I think the difference between you and some other people is you've had that background, that blood, that fiddle blood running through your veins. Just what you said, you have that. Not all musicians, I don't have that as a drummer and a guitar player. You know, so, and I think that informs what comes out of an instrument, obviously.
Yeah, I do too. And the story goes that, you know, when I was a little kid, I remember vaguely 6-7 years old wanting to play music with my dad. I was like, Dad, I want to, you know. And I was a little too small to play the guitar, which was what I wanted to do first. Right. And so he said, try this. And so I picked up the fiddle. There's more to that backstory, but basically when he handed me the fiddle, it became an opportunity for us to hang out. He's a busy guy, you know, and when it was just me and him, two fiddles, that's when it was, you know, he was the most present with me, and I liked that.
I mean, you're able to now spend a lot of time with your daughter, but, you know, kind of traditionally, especially in that generation, the fathers were not around.
No.
The mother was the mother, and the father was the father. Hey, come in here. And then he passed away. Tell us about, you know,
I think for him, and what I remember, he was just, you know, born and raised in that 40s and 50s lifestyle of, you know, the white t-shirt with the cigarette, non-filter cigarettes rolled up in the sleeve, working in the garages and, you know, fast, big motor cars. And especially in Berlin, New Hampshire, we're Hockey Town USA. He was a hockey player with his brother, really kind of physical, scrappy, you know, not afraid to throw down his gloves and fight for his team. And I say that loosely. You know, he lost all his teeth by 25, being a hockey player, and just lived a really, really hard and, you know, wasn't afraid to take risks kind of thing. And it just caught up to him, you know, smoking and drinking and just living hard. He also had rheumatic fever when he was a kid, which they say, I've been told, that it takes a toll out of the heart. And he said the doctor said he had to be in bed all summer when he was 12.
Oh.
So he learned to not want to do anything with doctors, and that caught up with him. He went in for his AKGs because my mother asked him to at 52, and they said, we need to keep you overnight. He said, it's hunting season. You're not keeping me overnight. Take these things off me. I'm going home.
Really?
He died 2 days later.
Yeah, did he? Well, see, we started by accident talking about age here, and that brings us full circle to the point. So he was 52, but you're not a guy. I know some people that in my life that have known, well, my father lived to 47. When I was 45, I started to think I might have that heart attack. But yeah, you haven't lived that life.
No.
So you're not sitting there going, man, 52, I might be out of here. Yep.
No, I mean, the thought has crossed my mind.
Okay.
And it has influenced my choices in life. But, you know, I am my own person.
How did you go? Not the way of the Hockey Town USA. How come you didn't go that way? Maybe you did for a while.
Go that way? What do you mean?
Hockey Town USA, I'm pretty sure they might have had a pop or two after the game. And that adds to that.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think I definitely inherited the adventurous sort of like determination and really kind of curiosity that my father had in just living adventurously. And
right.
So at 19, I moved away from the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, and I went to Nashville. And that was instead of going to college. And so I lived pretty hard. You know, when you come out of high school and you go to a new place, It's like all these new things and influences and experiences. And in the music world, especially, you know, the party lifestyle is just dangling right there the whole time. And I will say that I have dabbled heavily in that party lifestyle.
But you don't anymore?
No. And to be specific, it was alcohol that was really fun at times, and then it was counterbalanced with not being fun. Then I ended up with physical injuries because of skiing and whatnot. And then, you know, there's alcohol as a painkiller and then blah, 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 blah. And then it came full circle to me being like, you know, there's other ways to enjoy life than to just numb the pain.
Well, good for you. Yeah, since I've known you. Pete just gave us a 2, and now we're probably down to 120. So take us out with Maple Sugar and traditional. Do us the traditional Maple Sugar, what you would do at a fiddle contest, if you would. And your father taught you this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, go for it. So that's Patrick Ross bringing us out. Keep going. I'm sorry. Keep taking us out on the Maple Sugar. We'll be back with more Patrick Ross and his life. Very interesting life and more music. Hang in there. Keep going, buddy.
This is the intro to a song that I wrote. I would say it's called Blue Ribbon Time, and it was inspired by the work that you and I do together. And at that time, it was about 12 months ago that I wrote it ish. And you know, I'd been kind of working hard with you and other people, and teaching, and my job was kind of like, I wouldn't say overwhelming me, but it was like, hey, I like to have some days where I can just chill out and not have to work, just to kind of recharge the batteries. And so this song is for all the hardworking people out there who like to have some time off on the weekends.
Can you bring it up, Pete, a little bit? So this is the chorus. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I'm all right, and I got a plan to keep it that way.
What would you call that beat? Is that a Patrick Ross beat, or is that some sort of a groove that has a name?
Yeah, I would say it's sort of a laid-back country slash, I mean, country rock. I mean, the band, like Bob Dylan and the band, big fan of Levon Helm. And, that drumming kind of beat is inspired by Levon Helm.
Yeah. I like to keep Patrick off the drums myself. When we gig, we'll do Doug Perkins on the guitar and me on the drums and Patrick on the mandolin, fiddle, all these things, and guitar. And then I like to come out front with the guitar, and then Patrick sneaks back on the drums. I'm like, man, people don't want to see you on the drums, you know? Folks, thanks. It's, thanks Rick Singeri for having me in here, and Steve Cormier and Ken. And Pete Cormier producing. Thank you very much. And keep listening, because we have Patrick Ross for another half an hour. And then we have Ryan Cochran-Siegel, a World Cup skier who was raised in Starksboro, and his cousin Jimmy coming in, going to talk about World Cup and affordable skiing around here in Vermont. People say, why are you having skiers in the summer? Because that's when you can get them. Patrick, we just talked about your upbringing, and your father passed away young. Jesus, 52 is young, but I thought it was earlier. But anyway, what happens to a young kid now when their father's passed away?
Well, my sister and I went to go get my father for dinner one night. He was up in one of the cabins doing some plumbing, and we found him dead of a heart attack.
You walked down on your
phone? Oh, yeah. I thought he was joking. He was kind of a prankster. You know, he's on the floor, and I was like, ha-ha, very funny. And then very quickly realized that, I would never be able to play music with my dad again. And that was trauma, baseline traumatic event in mine and my sister's life, which then turned out to be very difficult for my sister, which we could get into, but
that's the next show.
Yeah. The music part of things, it was definitely a crossroads for me, an intersection where I was like, okay, now what do I do? You know, I remember coming back into the house, into my bedroom where my fiddle was already on my bed. I was waiting to play music with him that night.
Oh, really?
We were working on the tune. It was called Dragging the Bow.
Oh, yeah, I know that.
And it's just really, you know, it was difficult for me to pick up the instrument after that. And so my family, my mother's side of the family, huge, you know, big French-Canadian family. My mother's one of 13, all rallied and did a bunch of different fundraising events, spaghetti dinner fundraisers. And, you know, the short version of the story is that I ended up hearing about the Mark O'Connor Fiddle Camp in Nashville, Tennessee, and we raised money so that I could go to that, and it was definitely something that I carry with me to this day just because of the influences of all the various teachers at that camp from all over the world, including Natalie McMaster, Vassar Clements.
Yeah. So for people who are listening, Mark O'Connor's a cat. He's huge. He's heavy down there. And you were learning from him and all these other teachers.
Yeah. And because, you know, the story, the word got out that I had just lost my dad and I'm here at the fiddle camp because I don't know what to do. You know, Mark O'Connor himself took me under his wing and was like, here, man,
that's just unbelievable.
Sit here and we'll help you out, you know? And so that was pretty huge. So thanks, Mark.
Yeah, that's like Larry Bird saying to Rusty Deweese, come on, let's shoot hoops all summer.
Totally.
Oh man. So, where does your fiddle player? We can bring in Bambi called from Morristown. It might be Bambi Freeman, who's a friend of mine, and she's a farmer. Difference between the violin and the fiddle. So, Mark O'Connor, the preeminent fiddle player in the world, but you're going from Berlin, New Hampshire, playing fiddle with your dad and his boys, and then you got some people down there who are doing something a little different.
Yeah. And what it did was it showed me that it was not just, you know, the traditional fiddle tunes from Quebec and New England. There's a whole big world of this music and this instrument and how this instrument is indicative and is represented in every culture. And so.
So is there a difference between the violin and the fiddle, Bambi?
There is slight technical, physical differences. I would say that on a fiddle, you would have a flatter bridge, which is where the strings rest on. And then on a violin, you'd have a more rounded bridge. Other than that, it's really how you play the instrument. And right. So I can give you an example of that. When I got to Nashville, I was playing like I was playing earlier with that kind of sawing, dancing kind of. Yeah, that's fiddle. So the colloquialism is that fiddles dance and violins sing. Uh-huh. There was a teacher there called Paul Peabody, and he was a violinist, and he would do stuff like this. And I was amazed. I was like, how do you do that? And he showed me. And I was like, I can't do that. He's like, you keep practicing it. It's called ricochet bowing, and I bet you'll be able to do it. I was 11. And eventually I was able to do it.
Well, fiddles dance and violins sing.
Right.
That's like girls from Hardwick dance, girls from Burlington sing. It's sort of the same thing.
I'm going to leave that
one
alone.
Now, wait a minute. Am I going to be canceled for that? Is this cancel culture for saying that? But I can say men from Hardwick dance, men from Burlington.
There you go.
Sing.
All right.
Yeah, that's great. Because to be able to do, I will say, and you know, I don't run across a lot of fiddle players that can break out into what sounds like Brahms there. And so that's pretty interesting. And you got that down there from that one guy. And you said eventually. How long is eventually? If you just sat as a 14-year-old kid and said, I'm going to go from playing Maple Sugar a fiddle tune, and I'm going to learn ricochet bowing. How long does that take? How many days of 4 hours a day?
6 months.
So thanks, Pete. 1 minute. So people have to know that. You know, going, what would you say to someone who's 50 years old right now, who's sitting home going, geez, I can retire in 5 years, and I'd like to play the fiddle. I'm listening to Patrick Ross on the radio. I'd like to play the fiddle. There's no way I can play the fiddle. What would you say to that person?
I would say, unless you have a missing arm, you can.
All right.
It's just a matter of how far you will get down that path. based on, you know, how much time you have, how much natural ability you have, and how open you are to development.
Take us out. Can you do Dragging the Bow? We got 25 seconds. Okay. No. I don't want to lay anything on you that you haven't played for a while.
I think I can do it.
All right, so we're going out. Go ahead, Patrick.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
At Vermont Viewpoint with a guy named Patrick Ross, who's an extremely talented musician. That song right there, tell us about that one, and then Peter, bring it up a little bit for us after.
Little Red Camaro, a love song. My wife's mother kind of ribbed me and said, hey, what about writing a song for my daughter, my wife? Right? Uh-huh. And so it was easy. I was like, all right, sure. And it came out like this, just kind of a Cajun backbeat. The drummer in my new project, my new band, is from Louisiana, from New Orleans.
Oh, cool.
And so he's drenched in that culture of...
What's his name?
His name is Chad Brunet.
All right.
Yeah.
Bring that up a little. Pete, thank you, Pete.
And so, yeah, this is a blend in the band, because we kind of dip into the Acadian roots that I have. Yeah, that backbeat. Yeah, very.
Why don't you play
very...
a fiddle lead to that while sure. while you're on the radio? Play your own fiddle fiddle behind yourself.
Yeah. It's definitely kind of a Cajun fiddly thing, and I just been to festivals all my life, and when I hear music like that and I see people just get up off their chairs and they just can't stop moving,
it's
like
a dancing thing,
to me that is what music is all about.
Well, I had my first colonoscopy a couple months ago, and they make you drink the stuff and take two Dokolex, and he said dance to Cajun music. That's what the doc said.
I'll write that down and remember that when I get my first one.
I tell you what, don't do it till after you wake up. We went from Patrick growing up. He was born in Canaan. He went to, and then he was in Berlin with his folks, and his father passed away. And then he went down, studied with Mark O'Connor and Alison Krauss and all these people, and came back. So then you're kind of tell us the Nashville deal a little bit more. You're 19. You moved to Nashville.
Yeah. So 11 years old. First Mark O'Connor fiddle camp. And for 1 week a year in June, and I went for 6 years in a row every June. And that kind of helped me establish, a comfort level with Nashville. And I made some friends. And then when I was 19, I ended up moving to Nashville just because I knew some people down there from that camp. And I didn't know what was going to happen, but I ended up joining a band and touring nationally with, it was a job, and I picked up a job touring with a Celtic Christian rock band, and it was amazing. It was a union gig, and I made enough money to cover rent and food.
So too much too soon. It wasn't the right timing for you in your life, apparently. It didn't really work out.
So I joined that band as a hired gun, as a fiddle player. And then I started a band, and that band was called Blue Merle, with Lucas Reynolds, who was actually from Vermont, and he was the lead singer and the writer. And fast forward a year or two and a half later, there was a bidding war between Universal Records and Island Def Jam, L.A. and New York. And they eventually went on to sign a record deal after I got canned.
And then, but Did anything ever come of that band? Like the stars in their eyes? Did they ever get the stars into their eyes?
I would say yes. I would say yeah. I mean, they, you know, Luke, you know, good guy. Nothing against him. And, you know, in retrospect, I think they made the right decision by letting me go because I just didn't have the experience that they did. And I didn't even know what I wanted in life, except to play music. And, so they went on. They did great things. They're no longer a band. I moved to Colorado and I experienced other parts of my life that were not music related, which is something that I needed because music had been such a driving force and such a focused thing that I felt like my life was out of balance. And so moving to Colorado really kind of helped me, follow other interests, which then fed the music.
By the way, call in 244-1777, 1-877-291-8255. That's cool. We'll pick up at Colorado. We've had a couple callers who just left messages, and thank you. And, this one, from Matt, he said, and I see a note that Pete dropped us. Bob Coons, Island Pond. What does that mean?
So Matt wants to know what it was like to play with Bob Coons, electric guitarist extraordinaire, who lives in San Francisco, who toured and played with the Jerry Garcia Band. And who taught James Hetfield of Metallica how to play guitar.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, in this life, as you know, you meet people who have a gift, whatever it may be. And in this case, Bob Coons has the gift of playing electric guitar. And when I meet other musicians who have that gift, and we click, and we're able to, like, hang out off the stage and then on the stage, it's just like, you know, playing pickup ball with somebody you've never met. It's like, it's on. And so Bob Coons is a dear friend of mine, and I hope to be playing music with him this summer in Island Pond again, late July.
So, Al, and how would people – what is it, PatrickRossMusic.com? Is that still up?
Yeah, PatrickRossMusic.com is where you can get the updates on the new project, the new band, some new music, music videos, the bio, and lots of other things.
Well, we have a couple gigs coming up. We have a Higher Ground gig. When is that going to be, February?
Yes.
Yeah, February, Patrick and I will be at Higher Ground, and I'll be on my truck – touring around. If you want a truck show in your town, you're the town clerk, give me a call. I just saw the town manager in the bagel place down at Casey's underneath, and he's like, I'm the town manager. And I called them the other day. So I'm going to try to – it's hard to get a place to park that truck. And then we'll do one in Newport, New Hampshire. We'll do some more. People say to me a lot, Patrick, they go – people say to me a lot, they go, that's like stupid to say that. You know what I mean? Some folks have said to me.
Okay, right.
It's interesting, they say, how do those musicians just like you, call them out of the audience and they'll get up there. And how come musicians can just play with other musicians? And, I say that I learned there's only really three chords to most songs. There's three chords and they follow a pattern. So to illustrate that musically, we're going to try to make it work. There's two mics in here. I'm going to play the guitar and sing one. Patrick doesn't know what I'm going to play, but you'll hear him play it. And he doesn't even know anything what's going on, and he'll figure it out.
Pressure's
on. And then he'll tell you why. I was born a running kind, leaving always on my mind. Home was never home to me at any time. Front door, side, outside. Almost always the exit for the running time. Front door found me open, outside the back door open. There must always be an exit, bring me home for the running game. So how did you know how to do that?
Yeah, it's, you know, I liken it. The first thought that came to mind is swimming. You know, when you get thrown into the water, you sink or swim. You know, and it's so and it's like just
but
using
I had
the
chords.
Ear.
I mean,
yeah, I mean
just...
listening and using. You know, I have been accused of having satellite dishes for ears. Quote from Mike Santasuso, bass player out of Burlington, around 1999.
That's a good quote.
So just listening, interpreting, and then. It's like a chameleon. A chameleon blends into the environment, right? And so adaptability is a mantra that I use often, just like how to participate without taking over.
Yes, but fundamentally, even more fundamentally, not in this spiritual, ethereal sense, you knew that you could see my fingers.
I could, but I didn't need to.
You didn't need to. Oh, yeah, you could hear. And then you hear that song. You know that that song is going from the first chord that you hear, and you know what it is by hearing, to the next chord. You know when it's going to go.
Yeah, I mean, there's experiential knowledge. Right. You know, after doing it for 30 years, and it's like the educated guesses become more accurate.
It's like if you just go to anybody who's not a musician, if you just go... Bum, bum, bum. A lot of them will go, bum.
Right.
Yeah, so that's cool. So now you're back from Colorado and you've gone through, you've learned some more things about a more complete life that you might be looking for. And by the way, you're into the outdoors wicked with this. And you have the Ophelia. How old's Ophelia?
She's 7 now. It was last week.
And this pandemic thing. This is me saying what I think, not what is quite true. Maybe is it allowed guys like you to be around the kid more?
Definitely, 100%. Yeah, and yeah, among other things, family time, but also
and the wife, more.
And my wife, which wife. You know, I would say Cindy and I get to hang out anyway,
yeah,
because
right.
of our schedules,
right.
And then you know, time with my daughter Ophelia was really awesome, but also. You know, a break from the touring schedule was good for me because I had this feeling inside of me for years of like, there's music that I haven't written yet that needs to come out. And I couldn't really find or make the time. I felt like I couldn't. And then the pandemic happened. I was like, oh, I have time. And so I wrote 20 songs during the pandemic. Two of them you heard a little bit ago and this new band. And so that really kind of became making cider out of crab apples.
Pete, do we have another break? Okay, in two. Hey, Pat, let's play another one. And
yeah.
then let's do a...
Sure.
Whatever you want to do. Play a mandolin.
I'll play a mandolin.
Patrick's going to play the mandolin on this, and I will take... Boy, I couldn't sing with the earphones on. I didn't.
That's why I have
the cans
off.
On. Yeah, so I got to take them off, and then Peter
just
takes
one.
Out. So this
like,
is Del McCurry and Grisman.
Yeah, I don't know who wrote it, actually.
No, I don't either. Let's see if we can do it here. Oh, yeah, play this here. So is it? Okay, you count it off.
One, two, three.
You played with my poor heart like a toy. That toy broke and then we had to part. It never will be mended. Hope its romance ended. Darling, you toyed with a toy heart. Darling, you toyed with a toy heart. I think you broke the game right from the start. This toy heart was broken when parting words were spoken. Darling, you toyed with a toy heart. Someday, time alone's gonna heal this broken heart. Then clouds gonna roll away, and the sun's gonna shine someday. Darling, you toy with a toy heart. Darling, you toy with a toy heart. I think you played the game right from the start. This toy heart was broken when parting words were spoken. Darling, you toy with a toy heart.
Thank you.
Patrick Ross. And don't forget, at the top of the hour, you got a little news on Vermont Viewpoint. Glad to be sitting in for Rick Singeri. And thanks, Steve and Ken and Pete and Patrick Ross for being in here. And then after the hour, hang on, and because we have Ryan Cochran Siegel and Jimmy Cochran, wicked skiing guys and local guys, and they'll be talking for an hour about skiing, and they'll take your calls. And so hang in there. And Patrick, one of the things we've been playing together for quite a while now, you know, you've been gigging on the shows, and thanks for coming to the shows and seeing Patrick and I, folks. You wrote a song, and then you sing and you play the fiddle at the same time. And when people be coming to the show, I'd be like, yeah, I got this guy, Patrick. Oh, he's wicked. You should see him. He sings and plays the fiddle at the same time. So can you do one of those? And tell us a little bit about that song. I like this song.
Sure.
I like it. This is my favorite one.
Thanks. So this song is called Holding Hands with Fire, and kind of tying it into the Mark O'Connor Fiddle Camp. John Hartford was, one of the instructors there. And he would sing and play fiddle at the same time. When I saw that, I was like, I want to do that someday.
Yeah.
And so this song I wrote when I was spending a lot of time over in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And it's called Holding Hands with Fire.
Go.
Time in the middle of the mountains, holding hands with fire. Looking back and looking hard, and nothing's gonna stop me now. But I raise my hands to the sky above, 'cause I know I will be there soon. Time on earth like a hurricane high, time on earth like rain in the sky, time on earth like a mountain climb, time on earth here we stand. 25 years with my eyes wide shut, and that's just fine with me. Amazing grace. Well, I'm going home to see my friends. Ain't nothing's gonna hold me down. Time on earth like a hurricane high. Time on earth like a rain in the sky. Time on earth like a mountain climb. Time on earth.
I love that. And that's hard to do. And
easier now. Done it a bunch of times.
You have done that.
And drumming has actually helped. So
really? Well, I remember you did that one time. We were bucking up for a good old Christmas show, and I had a chain there.
That's right.
And during the chorus, and I just started picking up the chain and dropping it,
yeah,
and we kept it in the show.
I'll never forget that.
Yeah. In fact, Pete Wilder, he was part of that, musician-wise, and his sons love that whole thing. They always talk about that. So thanks, Patrick Ross, for coming in. Jeez, I'm crow almighty. These things, they run out quick, you know. And we're going to get the Cochran boys in here at 10 o'clock, talk skiing and stuff. But let's go out playing. And tell us about, real quick, your new band. Yeah, play the fiddle. We'll do Truck Driving Man.
Sure.
Tell us about your new band and how people can get a hold of you to play out in their lawns.
Yeah, I'll just give you the short version. Chad Bernay is a drummer from Louisiana, New Orleans, Louisiana. He lives in Corinth now. Mike Connor T., congratulations on having your firstborn daughter, Maura, yesterday. And he's from Long Island, New York, lives in Thetford now. And he plays electric bass and trumpet, and I play lead guitar, and I sing. And PatrickRossMusic.com. You should go there.
To book, yeah, you should go there and get Patrick and see us on stage. And let's play. Let's go out. So this will give you some more Patrick Ross vocal harmony and some more Patrick Ross fiddle. And by the way, you know, he plays the mandolin, all this stuff, and the guitar. You're picking the telly now? Pretty hard. Strat?
Yeah.
That's that old Merle stuff. We love the Merle stuff.
Yeah.
Stick around for the 10 o'clock hour and the Cochran Boys. The Cochran Boys grew up on this type of stuff. There's Merle, right on the wall. I stopped at a roadhouse in Texas. Little place called Hamburger Dan's.
3 minutes.
Put my money in the jukebox. I played Truck Driving Man.
Pour me another cup of coffee, for it is the best in the land.
Peace slipping.
I put my money in the jukebox and play that Truck Driving Man.
Take a lead on the fiddle. Oh my God. I had to say a happy birthday to somebody, and I'll do it before the Cochran Boys come in, because I'll forget. Happy birthday to Amber's mom, up there in Alberg.
You, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Amber's mom. Happy birthday to you. I stopped that road.
No, that's the first verse. Oh. Well, the waitress, she poured me some coffee. I thanked her and I called her back again. I said, honey, this old song sure does get me. You know why? Because I am a truck driving man. Sing harmonies with me.
Pour me another cup of coffee, for it is the best in the land. I put my money in a jukebox and play that truck driving man. Let her rip, boy.
Them big wheels are rolling. We got a minute, Patrick. Just like Flash, I was gone. Whoa, that was Flash. Got them, something else or something. I was on my way to Burlington and I said,
pour me another cup of coffee, for it is the best in the land. I put my money in the jukebox and played that truck driving man.
Acapella.
Pour me another cup of coffee, for it is the best in the land. I put my money in the jukebox and played that truck driving man.
See you later. See you in a couple minutes, folks.
Yeah.
With them Cochran Boys.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Back with Vermont Viewpoint. That's Patrick Ross still playing that music, right? Yeah. And thanks, Patrick Ross, for coming in. He's heading back to Newbury. It's a classic old town in Vermont. And PatrickRossMusic.com. Rick Sengary Show here. I'm hosting. I'm Rusty. I didn't even say that yet. And then Ken Squire, thank you. I've known Ken Squire since I was 10. And he's been a mentor to me in what I was doing. And I thank him. He actually got me racing at Thunder Road, so that was funny. And Steve Cormier, I've known him back in Corman the Coach days. You remember Corman the Coach days, Jim? When you do say stuff. So we're in here with the Cochran guys. We've got Jimmy Cochran and Ryan Cochran Siegel. And let us just say, listeners, listen, number one. Number two, they're sharing a mic. So if there's a slight delay, it's they wouldn't delay coming out of the start house. You know what I mean? They're just delaying with the mics. We have to be doing some weird stuff. So, Jimmy Cochran, the elder, what's your job? You have a job now. What is it?
I'm the general manager of our family ski hill, Cochran Ski Area.
Which people have heard of, some haven't. What is it if they haven't?
It's a nonprofit ski area now in Richmond, Vermont. It was the backyard ski hill that our grandparents started back in the early 60s. And it's grown, not a lot, but it's grown. We've got a T-bar and snowmaking and tons of kids that come out and ski all winter long.
You also have a ski school there, right? How long has that been going on for?
You know, pretty much from day one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was a rope tow in the backyard that my grandfather built. And pretty quickly, the local kids started coming to ski. And the parents asked my grandmother to teach skiing. So she quickly became the de facto ski school director.
How do you – by the way, is there's a mountain bike deal going on there right now or not?
Yeah. You know, inevitably, there's just so much so much mountain bike growth in this state. And it's a big plot of land on that hillside. And so trails have been – there for probably 20 plus years now, but in the last 5 years it's grown tremendously. Yeah, after work, kids, I mean, tons of people come through to ride their bike. Yeah.
How do you get to Cochran Ski Hill?
How do you get there?
Yeah,
Cochran Road, Richmond, Vermont. It's a mile past the Round Church.
Okay, that's how people can identify that.
Yep, and there's great riding all through Richmond. I mean, there's great riding popping up everywhere in the state.
I know.
And the town of Richmond's no exception. Yeah, it's really a great place to come ride your mountain bike.
Yeah, and we'll Jimmy was on the World Cup tour for 7 years?
10 years.
For 10 years, and we'll talk about that more. And also skiing, affordable skiing. We have next to him is his cousin, Ryan Cochran Siegel, who is now – where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Starksboro.
Where'd you grow up, Jimmy?
I actually grew up in Keene, New Hampshire.
Oh, you did? Yeah. So Starksboro. So that means where did you go to high school?
Went to high school at Mount Abe.
Did you go to your prom?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah,
we had prom was at the Hilton down by the waterfront in Burlington.
And I asked you that not as a joke, but I asked you that because ski people, I went to Stowe High School, and back I graduated in 78. So the guys and girls that were skiing, all of a sudden they'd disappear for a long time. And that meant sometimes they didn't get integrated deeply into the school society. So maybe they didn't go to the prom because they didn't. But you did. You did a lot of school in there?
Yeah. So freshman year in high school, I was actually fully at Mount Abe. And then just with skiing, it gets really tough with all the travel. So sophomore through senior year, during the winter, I went to the Mount Mansfield Winter Academy. And Jimmy actually also went there.
That's in Stowe, right?
Yeah, in Stowe. Yep. Trained out of Mount Mansfield. And it was an awesome experience. And yeah, so that would run like kind of mid-November through end of March. And then between that time, I was fully public, fully at Mount Abe. So well immersed with both sides. Definitely had like my ski group of friends and then my Mount Abe group of friends. But
I guess it can work both ways. It could be if you just don't have a school group, it could be good too, you know. By the way, if you're listening and you're used to listening to the station to hear about, you know, price of milk and all that stuff, and how to get good mushrooms out of the woods and stuff, you know, whatever. These guys, it's as if we have the best basketball player on the team in the NBA here, sitting here. We don't have – and his cousin. So if you're listening, it's not like these guys like, oh, yeah, we're just – no, they're going down in Austria and hills that you can't even look at, and they're the best, not in America, in the world. In fact, this might perk an American's ear. Jimmy, you've been in how many Olympics?
Two.
You're an Olympian. This guy's been in how many?
Just one.
And you may go again.
Yeah, hoping. Working
how does
hard.
That happen? How do you – so right now, you're a World Cup –
yeah.
Great skier. You don't know if you're going or not. How's that work out?
It's all I mean, for every Olympics there's always qualification, and so there's different kind of results that you have to achieve before being named. And so right now all of from the start of our race season in October up to kind of like 2 weeks before the Olympics is when our kind of qualifications are ongoing. So.
And when you were doing that, Jimmy, thanks for that, right? When you were doing that, was that a real tense thing? You're just doing what you do?
Yeah, I mean, the first go-around, that was really stressful for me because I was right on the cusp. So it was right up to the, like, 2 weeks before the Olympics where I didn't know if I would make it or not. And it was the last race that I did that put me in. And the second time around, it was not stressful because I knew I was already going pretty early on. And you know, with Ryan's ability, he will be in that category for sure.
He's been there once.
Like you said, not just one of the best in the country, he's one of the best in the world.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, barring some crazy circumstances, he will be there.
Yeah, he'll be there, and then our DEV listeners will see him, or they can do what I do, which is like 7 in the morning. I go to the news and see what the first run, how he did in the first run. So you said the last race of your qualifier for your first Olympics, you got in. By how much time did like
it? Yeah, that I mean, it was. I'm trying to remember. It was between me and this teammate of mine, and I knew I basically had to beat him. And I think he crashed. So I think I was, you know, I didn't. And that was the difference.
Tell folks who don't know what a tech skier is, which is what you were. Is that
right,
correct?
Yeah, I was slalom and GS. So basically, I was going way slower than Ryan goes.
But turning a lot more.
Turning a lot more, yeah.
Which can be perilous.
Yeah, it's different for sure. I mean, yeah, Ryan risks his life every time he throws himself down those hills. But the part of the reason that Ryan is so successful is because he's good at all the events.
Right.
I was terrible at downhill. I was so slow. But, yeah, Ryan can do all four.
I saw one thing. When it said on your notes there somewhere I was reading, it said combined. So was that a combined, which was a slalom and a downhill? I was like, oh, Jimmy has done downhill. Obviously,
yeah,
you've done
yeah,
downhill.
Exactly. For the combined, I was able to do some of the World Cup downhills, which is, you know, neat for me to know those courses that Ryan is racing and have been down some of them. And like you said, it's you can't even imagine what these hills look like. They're so steep, so much terrain, blind rolls going 70, 80, 90 miles an hour.
What's a blind roll, Ryan?
Where you're kind of – it looks like a ski jump going into it where you can't see the backside. Sometimes they're jumps. Sometimes they're just, you know – like a lot of times too, you don't know where the gate is. I mean, you know where it is, but you can't see it, which makes it difficult.
Just to get, you know, I always just think I have to explain. I always think I have to explain what ski racing is to people, my buddies, you know, because it's like baseball and all that stuff. Ryan was NORAM Super G champion. That's of America. NORAM downhill and Super G champion. That was in 2011. Then downhill and Super G champion, better than any downhill and Super G skier in America in 2012. And that was, they said, like in 2 days or something, consecutive days. Or that was you. You did something in consecutive days or something. You don't even know. And then, overall, NORAM champ. You took the in 2014. This is Ryan. Last year, well, we'll get back to that in a second. And Jimmy's over here being a U.S. national title in GS and slalom on successive days.
Yep.
You won the U.S. national titles in GS and slalom on successive days. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was my first year on the ski team. So that was sort of my breakout year. But that was a long time ago. That was 2004.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm pretty old. But our careers overlapped by a little bit. We were both on the national team for, was it 1 year?
I think
2 years.
Oh, yeah.
It says you were 12th in the slalom in the Olympics. Who's sneezing at that?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's,
I can't stay awake watching the damn things, and you're getting 12th. You know what I mean? That's tell us the Olympic thing. Both of you guys, let's trade off. While the mic's at you, Jimmy, you're walking down. The flag is there. Is that what we would think it is?
It's a little. I would say, you know, my memories of the Olympics are of this amazing experience with all these fellow athletes from around the world. Your teammates, obviously, you spend a ton of time with them, fellow Americans, and it's really amazing to represent America at the Olympics. But you're with all these other people that you know really well, that you spend the year racing with, and all these other sports too, these people that you've never met that are all so thrilled to be there. So and it's really not, you know, it's so commercialized on TV the way most right. people experience it. And when you're there, it's there's none of that. It's very you're very sequestered, separated from the media, separated from the public. And it's really just about this sort of celebration of your sport and sports in general. So, yeah.
When you go back, Ryan, to the Olympics this year, what will you be prepared for that you weren't prepared for maybe the first time that made it maybe difficult?
Yeah, I think I definitely understanding the logistics of everything from like landing off the plane, going getting your uniform to opening ceremonies and also like competing in your events. I think there's definitely it's a different vibe and a different type of pressure that you feel. It's very you can see that like the world is focused on you, but I think there's also a separation with that where it's about letting all of that go and really just keying in on your events and on your the reason why you're there. The reason why you're there is to perform and to do your best and keeping that in mind. So I think also each Olympics is different just based on different countries that host and the different cultures too. So I think there's a part of it is embracing those differences and really appreciating that time, but just trying to take it all in and enjoy it.
But because you guys are skiing on this whole tour all year, it's one race or it's four or whatever, how many events you do. Out of many, 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 many. So when do you, this season, and when you were doing it, Jimmy, when did your coaches start saying, we got to start thinking about the Olympic hill? Is it just normal? It's just a normal next race coming, or because it's the Olympics? Is it like, you got to start concentrating on those those you know, blind rollers?
There's definitely preparation that goes into it. I think Beijing will be unique because no one's been on the hill. Usually they're prep test events, World Cups that they have beforehand, and because of COVID and things like that, that those actually ended up being canceled. So we've definitely all of our, I guess, viewing of the hill so far has been digitally. I mean, we have some recordings of what the hill is shaped like and those types of things, but it'll be definitely a big learning curve when we get there. So as of right now, I mean, my focus is on the first race of the year and getting ready for that.
And where is that?
That'll be in Sölden in Austria.
When is that?
It's the like October 24th, I think.
Okay, so all you listeners out there, don't forget to RS-C.
RC.S.
God darn, I was never good in high school. I was all learning how to ski.
Yeah. Me too.
RC-S on Instagram.
Yeah.
Do you have an Instagram presence, Jimmy?
Just Cochran Skier.
And what is that? How do we get there? Cochran's.com?
Or yeah, Cochran's.
Skiera.com. I've skied at Cochran's, and it's just as fun as it can be. For folks who are young, you want to do it because it's a great hill, and you might have some kids, and if you're even younger, it's a fantastic hill, and they give you the personal service. For folks who are older, around my age or even younger, you hearken back when you're at Cochran's. And we used to have a place behind Stowe Elementary School. It's called Marshall Hill.
Behind the motel?
It was a tea bar. Uh-huh. Behind the Town and Country in Stowe, the motel, Stu Ireland, Ireland Concrete,
yep.
He built the Town and Country. He put a bunch of mud back up there. He put this tea bar up there. And then they sold it. They took the tea bar, put it on Marshall Hill behind Elmish. I broke my leg there when I was 13. So I hearken back when I go to Cochran's. We've got about 40 seconds. Take us out.
Yeah, the small community-supported ski hill, that's really something that has fallen by the wayside a little bit in Vermont. And so we're trying to continue that tradition. And it happens to be that a rope toe or an old T-bar is the cheapest way to get people up the hill. So we stick with that. It works.
Right. Plus 30. Plus it's fun. When we come back, we'll talk to Ryan about his podium standing last year. But then there was a little break in the action. Also, we'll talk to him about skiing through the clubhouse at Cochran's. I've been doing my research.
Famous story.
You'll tell that one. So thanks. Come on back and listen with the Cochran fellas here. And thanks on the Vermont Viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's Patrick Ross's band. He's playing the fiddle. And he was in here earlier. Now we have Ryan Cochran-Siegel and Jimmy Cochran going to talk about World Cup ski racing and Cochran Ski Hill. Oh, what? Oh, let's leave out. Yeah, well, Jimmy wants to talk about it. But first, let's go to Ryan. I do want to let people know right away the level of skier that we're talking here. Last year, you got your – are those the first two World Cup podiums?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us about the GS win and his downhill second place.
Yeah, downhill second place in Val Gardena. That was – both were in kind of end of December of last year. And, I mean, there's just such a big lead-up kind of as you go into a season, and each race is really important. And I feel like I actually started the season out kind of slow and – sort of built up my confidence from there. I mean, the downhill track in Gardena is spectacular. It's just tons of air and a really flowy track, which I think as you learn and progress as a speed skier, you definitely have to figure out how to ski each venue. And on that day, things came together and was able to pull off a second place.
What would not be a flowy track? The more turns or less air?
Yeah, it's kind of
less jumps.
I think whenever it feels harsh, if turns, you know, you can't really connect turns. You kind of have to, like, piece them together down the hill. I think the trick in skiing is really trying to make each track flow, even when it doesn't feel like it naturally. I think the one that stands out in my mind is Kitzbühel is not necessarily the most flowing track. You definitely have turns that, you know, you have to dictate as, I guess, best you can, not expecting them to be perfect, and that's kind of the trick.
And Kitzbühel, the race is the
Hahnenkamm, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The people might have heard of that. What about your Super G win?
Yeah. So then it was like a week and a half later, just after Christmas. We always have two World Cups in Bormio, Italy. So had some really good training runs before, and then the Super G ended up getting switched for the downhill, so we ran the Super G first, and just kind of one of those days that everything comes together. I definitely skied really well and was just so focused in that moment and really keying in on my skiing and my turns and the terrain that I was skiing. And, I mean, when I came down, it was a pretty spectacular run. And
when you came down, you were leading. How many racers after you that could have overtaken you?
Yeah, so I ran, I think, eighth that day. And the way the seeding works is, like, the odd numbers, 1 through 19, are the top 10 ranked skiers in the world, and then evens, 11 through 20. So I was actually kind of in the back of that pack. And then, so there's still, yeah, I mean, seven of the top guys to go on top of, I think, 60 racers total. So there's a lot of waiting. But with conditions and kind of just how the day was going, I mean, I came down with a 7/10 lead over the next best guy, and he's no scrub either. So
you had an unbelievable run. But there's just – so now you're – the ski racing is like – is a really ridiculously close, dangerous thing. Now you've skied the best run of your life, perhaps. Now you have to worry about your emotions, keeping them in check. You can't even relax until those seven skiers are down. What are you doing? Because you go and you stand on the podium in first place, off to the side.
Yeah, so with the World Cup, they have a, like, Audi's a major sponsor, so they have the Audi chair that you sit on if you're in the leader's box. And so I sat there. There's some time with TV breaks to go and do interviews, and you kind of – it's a lot of rushing, being in the right place at the right time. So, and waiting and watching the guys ski. They have a huge board that you can watch their live run. So getting to see that, and you kind of have a pretty good indication of your own performance.
So you're sitting there saying, "Well, I'm happy with my run." So you must live on that. I'm happy with my run. If I get third place, I'm still thrilled.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think, and I think where my mind was at then too was like it was less about results and more about how I was skiing. And so if someone comes down and beats me, then that's like awesome for them, and they deserve it. You know, not being reflective of like, oh, I should have done better. I did as best as I could.
So the difficult part, I mean, tennis, you can fault all day. You can make mistakes all day. Basketball, there's four other guys or girls. With ski racing, what's the highest speed you get in the Super G and then the downhill? People always want to know that.
Super G, I bet, I don't know, 70 miles per hour, like straightaways. It depends on the hill. Downhill's usually higher. I feel like high 70s, 80s. Couple places on the World Cup you get up to close to 100 miles per hour in the right conditions. But
and you're not like those pansy football players with pads and thigh guards and helmets and go off to the side, take oxygen in between. You get to sit there for 5 minutes. No, you're wearing what?
Yeah, I mean, not a whole lot. I would never call a football player pansy. I'm definitely not built for that. But yeah, trying to, I think your protection's minimal, like a back protector, helmet, the essentials, but it's a lot of just your body out there.
And let's hear about Ryan when he didn't have those protectors on. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So from a young age, we knew Ryan was going to be a downhiller because he was always bombing down Cochran's at maybe not 100 miles an hour, but I'm sure he felt like he was going 100. But so we have a tradition at Cochran's where the last run of the day, you start at the top and you tuck all the way down the hill and you try and ski all the way up to the lodge.
Oh.
The lodge is up this little hill at the bottom. So, and you don't want to have to hike, obviously. So, and this tradition is, I mean, probably 50 years old. It goes back to when you actually had to ski up and over that same hill to get to the old lodge, which was a little farther down the hill, and you didn't want to have to hike over that hill where the new lodge currently sits. So anyway, this was 2001, I think, right?
Yeah,
2001. It was the 40th anniversary. So big party happening at Cochran's, you know, grill, burgers. And it was one of those days where it had rained 2 days before and then frozen as glare ice. And so we're doing the bombing run. And Ryan, of course, goes so fast. 8-year-old, you can imagine, full tuck. Probably had your skin suit on. Yep. And he goes up the hill towards the lodge and at the last second realized how fast you were going.
Yeah,
well,
I was in the air.
Oh, so he's in the air. He's in the air headed towards the lodge and he realized this was going to end poorly. And so there's a bank of windows on the front of the lodge and he just smashed right through one, right into the lodge.
Wait, how did you get hurt? Did you get hurt bad?
No, I was totally fine. The one I had a little scratch, which I still have a scar from on my right butt cheek. I don't know how that ended up there, but that's what I get.
But you want to have some Cochran lore. I mean, what is your Cochran lore? You're running the place now. That might be yours, but
yeah.
You want to own some lore? Do you
have
any?
My bad moves at Cochran's are, you know, getting the groomer stuck or throwing wrenches or. But you know that's another tradition that goes right back to my grandfather from the early days. So I try and keep that.
That's the Cochran way.
Yeah.
Throw the wrench. Yep. Now you're a married fellow.
Yep, married.
And some kids. Kids.
First son Oliver is about 11 months old. So he's
really?
Not quite skiing yet, but we're hopeful that this year he'll be able to slide around a little bit.
So that's a fact. I mean, he could be a year and a half, and you can get him up there. Yeah, you do the thing.
We'll see. Yeah. Hopefully he likes that. We joke about that you know. Hopefully he likes machinery and skiing.
10 seconds. We're going out. We'll be back with the Cochran boys. Thanks a lot. We'll talk about whether they were pushed into it or whether they loved it.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Ryan Cochran Siegel and Jimmy Cochran here, and Ryan's telling Jimmy and I about when he had to exit Europe when the COVID thing locked up, when Trump locked up. But there's this thing called the Cochran way, and it could be any way of your folks did. By the way, Vermont Viewpoint sitting in for Rick Singeri. And, everyone, so some listeners might not know that there's this whole family of people who have been in the Olympics and have performed well in the Olympics and have been on the World Cup. It's very unusual. You know, it's not like Shaquille O'Neal's kids are in the NBA or will his, you know, grandkids be. So give us the numbers and some of the names. Ryan, why don't we start with you and talk about why that is maybe.
Yeah, so I think it starts with Jimmy, our parents, my mom, his dad, and then our two aunts. Mm-hmm. They were all grew up skiing in Vermont and eventually made the national team, all competing in the Olympics. My mom,
their father made the hill.
Yeah, yeah. So our grandfather, Mickey Cochran, he's the one that it was his kind of dream to build the ski area. And so from that, they definitely were able to succeed in the sport of ski racing. And then, I mean, the next generation, our generation, we kind of followed in their footsteps for whatever reason.
There's two of you and
yeah, two
also
of us. So I'm the – I think there have been 10
okay
people of our family to be on the national team, and then six of us have gone to the Olympics.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. So Jimmy was – I guess Jess was the first of our generation to make the team, and then you, and then Tim and Roger, and then myself and Robbie. But – it's been I think just like, I don't know, it's interesting as to why there's been so much success. I think obviously being able to grow up at the ski area and have kind of access to that frequently during the winters was very key, but I think also love for sport, and that's a pretty big driving factor as well.
There's more of a chance of being a president of the United States than being on the podium at the Hahnenkamm. Like if you're born today, You can say, one could say, the parent could say, you can be the president of the United States. There's a fairly good chance you couldn't be. But don't plan on winning the freaking Hahnenkamm, you know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, I really believe that. I really do. Because everybody can't ski. If I throw you the football, you can catch it. You can throw the football. Most people can. Most people can drive. Race car drivers just drive a lot faster. So what is your look on that point of view on this that so many people have made it skied in the World Cup? It's you can't just do that. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is sort of what you're driving at, but it is unfortunate that you can go throw a football in your backyard, or you can go play basketball at your park, you know, local park, or everybody drives a car pretty much, and skiing is not very accessible, and that's partly what we've decided to push at Cochran Ski Area is we want to make it accessible.
And how are you doing that?
Yeah, and we feel like, you know, in this state, in Vermont, it should be like playing soccer or basketball or driving a car. It should be something that every kid has the opportunity to experience. And, you know, for our family, with that backyard ski hill, for whatever, you know, it's probably we're overly competitive, but it seemed like putting some gates in the ground and skiing around them as fast as you could was just a logical next step. And so we still try and carry that as well. And it's, yeah, you talked about the Cochran way a little bit. And I feel like one of the main points with that my grandfather always said, or maybe he didn't say it outright, but he always believed, is there's always going to be gates on the hill, but we're never going to make the kids run them. You know, it should be on the kids' terms, the athletes' terms. And I feel like our generation, we really benefited from that. I mean, we had parents that, you know, Ryan's mom is a gold medalist. Mm-hmm. She won a gold medal in the Olympics in ski racing. And my dad won the Hahnenkamm combined.
So his name Bob?
Bob, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. But I never felt like they pushed us. I felt like we just grew up loving what they loved, which was skiing, competing, sports in general, and it was never really pushed. It was something that we just kind of fell into loving because they loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a delicate balance in sports. It's hard to justify putting so much of your life and your, you know, emotions and, you know, injuries and you know, it's a sport. Like, why do it? But somehow it does, you know, it brings a lot to the quality of our lives for sure, no question. And it seems to be something that helps a ton of kids at our little ski hill. And so, yeah, I hope that we can always maintain that balance of keeping it fun and yet still making it something that kids want to push themselves and learn and kind of, maybe capture some life lessons there.
I said we were talking about Ken Squire before in the studio here with Ryan Cochran Siegel and Jimmy Cochran. Please call 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And I said, Ken, you know, used to own Thunder Road, and I raced at Thunder Road for 4 years. So and it wasn't in my blood racing cars. So there's some, but there, I learned enough that there's something about racing. And with ski, with stock car racing, it's failure, failure, failure statistical. You can always say, well, you know, did 25 laps in the last five. We were really, you know, that tire finally came in. It was the right temperature and I was holding. So you can take that, but you lose. What is it about racing? Do you guys think is a broad question, but there's something that's, I'll use the word addictive to racing. Why do you spend all these times, all this time getting hurt and everything coming back? Ryan, what do you think? Cause you're in the middle of it all right now.
Yeah. I feel like early on, it's always about the dream of, being the best in the world or like, you know, that type of drive. Really, I feel like I felt that at a young age, but I think as you progress through your career and, I mean, you achieve results and I think you achieve failures as well. You recognize, I think it has to be more than that. It has to be more than just a winning race. It's about your own personal growth. And I think on race day, I always feel, when I'm skiing my best, it's about kind of zoning in on what I can be doing and that kind of pushing that boundary of what I've been able to do and seeing where it can go from there.
You were pushing the boundary. You'd gotten a first and a second, and now you're up on the Kitzbühel and the Honeycomb, and you're coming down there, and you're on a roll in your career. And the first split, you're ahead. And then you didn't make it down, and what happened?
Yeah, it was
this last year?
Yeah. So this was back in end of January, and so Kitzbühel is, we always say, the Super Bowl of ski racing. It's the most kind of notorious ski race in the world, and it's definitely a very challenging hill. And so I was three-quarters of the way down the hill, and I think fatigue had set in a little bit and just trying to let things run out. And I kind of went over a little roll just in the wrong position, and skis went one way that I was not planning on. And eventually...
How fast?
I don't know. We ski with these GPS trackers, and I think it was probably in the 70s, I'm guessing. But I eventually lost control, and this section is a pretty notorious section. The traverse in Kitzbühel, it's just, you're skiing sideways down this incredibly steep pitch, and basically took a right-hand turn straight into the net, and I ended up pretty much going in. I mean, I went in head first, but pretty extended, kind of scorpioned into the net and ended up fracturing my C7. So it was a very quick turn of events. But I think also those are the risks you take in this kind of sport. And
where are you in your rehabilitation / getting ready for your heading over to Zermatt?
Yeah, heading to
where are you physically?
Yeah, so actually, I recently got fully cleared from my doctor.
Oh, great!
Which is pretty awesome. Yeah, so I was able to ski a little bit out in Mammoth in May, and now the next plan is to return fully training in Zermatt in Switzerland in August. So,
what are you doing right now for the listener out there that likes to keep fit? You're an elite athlete in the middle of your career.
Yeah, so we have. I think people think of ski racers as only doing stuff during the winter, but it's definitely a full year profession. So right now it's a pretty intense physical training that I undergo, and that the US ski team kind of supplies us with that plan. So
A
lot of I have gym workouts, field workouts, and then also a lot of time on the bike or hiking or those types of things. So right after this I'll be heading to the gym and getting in a workout.
Yeah, the Y.
Oh yeah, the Y in Burlington. Yeah,
you're going down to Stone Soup after, man.
Yeah.
Have you been?
Yeah.
Not to change that. Well, I want to hear. Thank you for all that, Ryan. Yeah. So you folks, you got to follow Ryan RC-S on Instagram. But he's going to be racing in October, and you can follow the Boston Red Sox or whatever. But this is exciting because you see the first run. With downhill is only one run.
Yeah.
But what are you racing this year for events?
Yeah, so the plan is giant slalom, super G, downhill, and then combined.
Oh, so a lot of events. So you'll be able to follow Ryan doing a lot of things. Jimmy, what's your whole thing? What do you think of that racing? Because when I was racing cars, man, you just, when you won, it was stratospheric. But then you usually went home thinking, I should never drive again. You know, what's your feeling?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Ryan articulated that really well, but I always thought about it as enjoying the process and finding, yeah, little small victories. Like you said, the last five laps, I really, really nailed it. Mm-hmm. Whatever. It's, I think you have to be able to not focus on the overall result and just focus on, yeah, the little things.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you enjoy the process and you enjoy those small little challenges and victories, then, and, you know, maybe not worry about, let the sort of bigger picture go. That's pretty great space to live in.
Great space, and probably helps you win. Helps you be competitive. But are the coaches allowed to fret more, or should a coach, this is your opinion, should a coach possibly have that same attitude in the student that, you know, our kids are skiing good, they're doing good, even though, you know.
Yeah. So when I was done racing, I coached at UVM mm-hmm. for 5 years. And it was, I went in as, you know, coming right off the World Cup, and I had these ideas about coaching, and I definitely learned a ton. And the main thing that I learned as a coach is that as a coach, you have very little power to help, very little power to do good. You have huge capacity to mess someone up.
Oh,
right?
All right.
You have to be really careful. You really have to let them do it themselves and be encouraging and be aware of the psychology involved and help where you can, but also make sure you're not introducing too many concepts or saying the wrong thing. I was not prepared for that at all as a coach, that, you know, really staying out of the way, sometimes it's the best path. And, you know, doing the little things, like, you know, I'm gonna carry coats today, or I'm gonna shovel the course, mm-hmm. or, you know, just doing things that aren't coaching as you think of them.
With actors, it's often said, it could be a young actor, it could be some, you know, that never took an acting lesson or whatever, they're good, you know. And then people will say, don't ever go to acting school, because what you're doing naturally right now is just right. And once you get a certain coach, or even any coach that's trying to do good, it's going to make you think too much. So that's just one fragment of what you could mess up on a racer's mind. I never heard that. That's the greatest thing I ever heard, man, about coaching. There's a huge potential to mess up. I think that's life in general. When we come back, we're going to be here with the Cochrane fellows for another 10 minutes. We got to go under a break. But I do want to talk about Cochrane Ski Hill and when they're open and what you'd have to pay to ski there, and the potential there to have a lot of great runs and a lot of good family fun there at Cochran's. And you could do that at Stone Mountain Resort too, but, you know, it's a little rough. So we'll be back with Ryan and Jimmy, the Cochran fellers. See ya. Back on the Vermont Viewpoint. This is Rick Sangari's show, and I'm hosting it today. I'm Rusty, and we had Patrick Ross, who's a great musician, and hey, Pete, when will this be up on to listen to podcast? If people are just tuning in now and hearing the Cochran's, but they didn't hear Patrick.
I can find that out for you.
What's that?
I can find that out for you.
See if you can. Yeah. All right. And anyway, Jimmy Cochran and Ryan Cochran, they're World Cup skiers, former Jimmy and Jimmy present. General manager of Cochran's, and I got you this because Ryan's got some lager swag, man. And I got you this. I don't know if you have that.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
When you go into Cochran's, you couldn't last year, I don't think, into their clubhouse, I call it. The cool thing for me is to see the bibs from Wengen, which is the Lauberhorn. Yeah. And the bibs that these guys wore over the years is really cool. So, and then Scotty Moe's working there.
Yeah. And so we brought you some hats. So, yeah, and maybe correct me on some of these wrong details here, but so Mo, as we know him, Scott Moriarty, who's a friend of yours, right?
Yeah, yeah, he was ahead of me in high school. Yeah, absolutely.
So his family has an amazing skiing history as well.
Marvin.
And his grandmother made Moriarty hats.
Annabelle Moriarty.
And so Mo has continued the tradition, and so we have Cochran's hats that are Moriarty hats. So we brought you a couple today.
Thanks a lot. You know, damn it. I should have thought of this earlier. We could have given some of these away, but I'll give him away on some sort of a...
Yeah, cool.
And I'll promote him again.
Yep.
Yeah, the Moriarty hat, you can, I don't know, you can, Marvin Moriarty started wearing them over there, and his mom just knitted them, and so go to Moriarty, it's a weird name to spell, but you can spell it, M3, Moriarty hats, and they're the greatest hats ever, the Three Peaks. You know, my mom had Annabelle make me one, it was orange, and it had a Snoopy.
Cool.
Snoopy on it. I don't have it anymore. I don't know where it went. Anyway, when we go to Cochran's to ski this winter at Richmond, we'll be asking, I'll already know, how Ryan did in the latest race. And,
yeah.
And I want to know when you can ski and how much it costs.
Well, yeah, so you sort of touched on this. For us over at Cochran's all winter, it's so fun to be able to follow Ryan. You know, we've got kids getting on the bus and coming over from the elementary school and going skiing, and we're checking out what Ryan's doing in Austria and Italy and all over the world. So it's really, I'm sure for these kids, they really can't conceptualize that, but it's pretty amazing to have Ryan as an ambassador out there racing and inspiring these kids. And the crazy thing that they probably take for granted is that he'll be in Austria, Italy, these places, and then he'll come back and he'll be out there, you know, maybe loading tees or skiing or, you know, helping his mom.
I did run the rope toe for a day too this year.
Yeah. With a broken neck, or was that before the?
Yeah, celebrity. Tough guys. Running the place. So, yeah, no, it's really fun for us to be able to live vicariously through Ryan and his amazing exploits.
Yeah.
So Cochran's, we open as early as we can in December, which is usually the first or second weekend in December.
Because you have snowmaking.
Because we have snowmaking, yeah. That in the past 10, I guess 12 years now, we've had modern snowmaking and grooming, and it's part of the reason we've survived these years. And that was able to happen because we became a nonprofit and we were able to fundraise. Mm-hmm. And really the community stepped up and said, yeah, we believe in this mission and we want to see it continue. And
when's your fundraising sale going to be? Are you going to have it this year?
Yeah. So that's the first weekend in November every year.
Oh, what's
the Cochran ski sale. Yeah. And it's a great place. It really ties into the affordability thing where you can come to the Cochran ski sale. It's actually at Camel's Hump Middle School.
Yeah. I've been there. I bought stuff.
It's a great place to get used equipment. And that can start you down the road getting into the sport. You know, kids, they grow so fast. So if you need skis for your four-year-old, you're not going to buy them new. You can come to the ski swap and get them for, you know, $20. And
by the way, when you go to the Campbell's Hump Middle School for the Cochran Ski Swap, they have some product there. It's not like get there early because there's one pair of skis that are going to fit your kids. I mean, it's loaded, rooms and rooms and rooms of stuff.
Vendors come from all over New England with a huge amount of brand new equipment.
And that's a fundraiser for you folks.
Yeah, that directly supports the ski racing kids at Cochran.
Oh, okay.
Yep. It's specific to ski racing, yeah. The Cochran Ski Club is the sort of ski racing arm of the whole effort over there, and they run that ski sale, and that subsidizes their coaching and gates. And
what about your Friday night $5 deal?
Yeah, that's the best cheapest way to come skiing at Cochran's. It's $5. Kids under 5 are free, we do dinner as well. It's $12
you get
dinner, $6 for kids to have dinner. So yeah, it's popular with the dads that are in charge cooking that night, so they come skiing with the kiddos and get dinner, get them fed.
That's great. So get on Cochran's.com right now. Ryan, go out with you. We got 2 or 3 minutes. You're heading where to train, and then again, when's the first race? And what, you know, Jimmy's talking about the folks following you over at the ski hill, but the guy at home, the girl at home, how do they follow you best when you're racing?
Yeah, so, well, first, heading over to Switzerland, beginning of August, we have a training camp over there. There's some glaciers that we get to be on and try to get up to speed as quickly as possible. And then first race is, end of October. I think it's usually around October 24th. There's a GS in Solden, Austria, another glacier. And then really the season kicks off kind of like Thanksgiving weekend, and then we're just full bore the rest of the year through kind of mid-late March. But, yeah, it's...
They get on. They get online. How do you know they get online when they see a race? They get on the U.S. Ski Team, see the schedule.
Yep.
And then I think, does NBC carry these things?
Yeah, I believe right now it's through the Peacock app. So it's one of those like $4.99 a month memberships, or I believe, where you get access to every race, men and women, throughout the season, and they'll show it live as well, and then usually you can see the recordings later on too. So depending on your schedule, it's tough. I mean, most of the races are in Europe, so different time zone and 6 hours ahead is hard to wake up early morning to see.
I know a couple guys that do it.
Yeah,
one of them's listening right now.
Yeah,
but I get up in the morning and check. And don't forget the folks listening. This is an Olympic year, and you know, Ryan's going to be representing us over there, and you can say you knew him when. If you're listening to this, he you know, this January break, he might be loading you on the T-bar at Cochran's. You know what I mean? Literally, if he's able to come by. So thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for coming in, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
yeah.
you.
And RC-S on the Instagram. He needs followers. And Jimmy, thanks a lot for coming in and talking about your career and the Hill.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah. I told Ryan, he came up to the barn, did a barn event, and I said, I would rather be talking to you. If I could have chosen to have Robert De Niro and Larry Bird there to interview, or him. I mean it. I mean, I am crazy about skiing. I grew up in Stowe, Vermont. My parents moved from Philadelphia to Stowe, Vermont. I'm seven. And my dad, Greyhound bus driver, waiting at the bottom of Spruce with his Bolex, taking pictures of me, coming down on the gate side. And then MMSC would get done at 10 seconds out. MMSC would get done at around 4 o'clock on Sundays, or, you know, 1 o'clock, and I'd run the gates. And they'd be like, I say, I want to run those gates. And I never raced, though. All right, we're out of here with Vermont Viewpoint. Thanks a lot, and I'll see you later. Bye. Oh, Rusty Deweese, Rusty.Deweese Instagram. Follow mine. I'm naked sometimes.
Now we sing sweet harmony, this winding road.